This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. America has three trends that are on a collision course: an aging population, climate chaos, and what has been described as an epidemic of loneliness. So you say, how do these disparate facts converge? Well, when the weather assaults a community, history and logic suggest those most affected, which equals the greatest number of deaths, is among the aging population. That goes for hurricanes, fires, and all other manner of natural catastrophe. We'll discuss it all today here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Danielle Aragone, and she is the Managing Director for Policy and Solutions at the National Housing Trust. Previously, she was the Director of Livable Communities at AARP, and she led the efforts there to help communities implement safe and walkable streets, age-friendly housing, transportation options, and greater opportunities for residents of all ages to participate in community life. And I think that's a very important thing when we begin to discuss what it is we're here to discuss, which is Danielle's new book called Climate Resilience for an Aging Nation. And you say many things in this book that I think are really worth noting. But the one that really hit me was that our climate changes are on a collision course with our demographic trends. Explain that just to get us going.
That is the thing that concerns me, is that we have these increasingly frequent and intense disasters that are fueled by climate change. And we know that because we can see year over year that there are more disasters that cause $1 billion of damage every year. Year over year, we see that trend continuing, as well as we see radical shifts happening in our population. So 100 years ago, one in 20 people was over 65. Today, about one in six is. And older adults are actually the fastest growing demographic group in the U.S., such that by 2034, we'll have more people over 65 than under 18 for the first time ever. So you've got these increasingly intense and frequent climate events on a collision course, as you said, with our demographic future, which I think sets up a lot of urgency, really, for communities to think differently about how to plan for that climate future.
Well, having read this book, of course, it really dawned on me all the things that you were trying to say just in your title. But the fact is that a lot of people might be saying, well, why does climate change affect older Americans more than it does the rest of us? And there are many compelling reasons if you stop to think about it.
Yeah, there really are. And I think, in some ways, it's rooted in kind of a lack of understanding that we have about who older adults are. Unlike children, which, people stop being kids at age 17, at least according to the letter of the law.
Well, I don't know anymore.
Right. Well, technically, they're adults at 18. But there's no magic marker that says when you magically become an older adult. Some people think it's age 50 when that AARP membership card makes its way to you, or others think it's 55 when you qualify for the retirement community, or 62 when you claim Social Security, so on and so forth. There's an array of dates that really begins to define what older adults are. And I think by virtue of that lack of understanding, there's also a lack of understanding of who the cohort of older adults are and what some of their vulnerabilities are. And I think that's where you get into the sort of unique conditions that climate is having for older adults, because we don't necessarily understand who older adults are as a cohort. When you look across that cohort of people, generally 65 and above, you know, it turns out that about 15% of them live at or near the poverty line. About 30% of them live alone. And the vast majority, I should say, live in the community, not in nursing homes or assisted living facilities, which I think is often the presumption, which then, you know, suggests that someone is there looking out for them. The reality is only about 4% of older adults live in facilities like that. So 96% are living in the community, and of those, about a third are living alone. And moreover, you know, the AARP it's had a statistic for some years that says older adults outlive their ability to drive by anywhere from 7 to 10 years. And I think that time frame is probably increasing with our life expectancy, but the reality is that about 20% of older adults don't drive. So when you think about just those few data points, and those are just a few of them, in terms of what that means for your ability to set in motion, you know, an evacuation plan or to make amendments to your house or modifications to your house that would help you prepare for more extreme weather or, frankly, longer, hotter summers, which is not necessarily a singular disaster event. It's more like a seasonal shift that we now need to prepare for. There's a lot of elements that are commonplace to older adults that begin to set up kind of a challenge when it comes to dealing with our climate future.
And by the way, just because you mentioned the heat, I mean, I did a podcast recently with the author of The Heat Will Kill You First. I mean, I think older adults are so susceptible to that. You have to really gauge when you're going to be going outside, particularly when you're living in many of the climates where people seem at an older age to want to gravitate toward.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Being Florida, Arizona, Mexico, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So I think you might want to put an accent on that.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. One of the statistics that really shocked me is that about 12,000 people die from heat-related illnesses each year, the most of any sort of weather-related illness, and of those, 80% are older adults. And so when you think about just on a daily basis kind of what extreme heat means for an older adult, first of all, if it's one of those people who lives at or below the poverty line, they may be very concerned about the cost of their utilities such that it prevents them from turning on the air conditioning to keep themselves cool. If they live alone and maybe they have a pet or maybe they rely on public transit to get places, they, in an extreme heat situation, they can't necessarily leave their house because of the heat to get to the bus stop, much less waiting at the bus stop for the bus stop to come, or walking their dog, or walking to the grocery store. So when you begin to really unpack what it means to live in conditions like that for an older adult, and I should say, you know, one of the other really compelling realities for older adults is about 80% of them live with two or more chronic medical conditions. And we know that extreme heat is a risk multiplier for people with hypertension and heart disease and things like that. So if doctors haven't made that connection for older adults in terms of their risk vulnerability, frankly, just the sheer discomfort of living in an environment that hot is going to really be a real challenge for older adults to overcome.
Now, the dichotomy that I want to talk about, you've got the federal government, which primarily some say is a defense contractor who happens to run an elderly health service, meaning Social Security and Medicare. Obviously, that's an exaggeration. But then you've got the local and state governments that are primarily focused on the future, and they're looking at what they need to do to educate the next generation. So my question is, does this whole issue of age resilience in a community fall between the cracks somewhere?
I think it does. And I think this is part of the problem. And one of the things, again, that, you know, when we talk about this collision course, you've got this intense climate change trajectory happening, and you've got a whole slew of agencies and professionals and trained industries focusing on that, you know, climatologists and data folks and emergency management preparedness folks. Then on the other side, you've got people who are thinking about the aging of our country. Those are the gerontologists and the demographers and the healthcare professionals in many cases. Talk about falling through the cracks. Those two bodies of work don't meet that often. So there's a lot of work in between there that falls between the crack as well. And that's exactly why I think the intersecting risks here are so poorly understood. You've got, you know, work and attention falling between the cracks in that regard. And then you're right, when it comes down to the federal, the state, the local, and I'll argue too, the community-based organizations, going even further local, it's not really clear who's responsible for what in some cases. So certainly, you know, the federal government administers the Older Americans Act and all of the programs that go into helping people age in place and support home and community-based services. They also develop our risk maps and our flood maps and implement disaster recovery programs. Those are two separate agencies, right? One is HHS, one is FEMA. Again, there's not necessarily the sort of connective tissue between that work that needs to occur. And that then is mirrored all the way down as you cascade down the levels of government. I do think that at the local level, it is the place where you can make those connections forge the best and maybe even the easiest. Because it becomes very clear, you know, to a mayor or to a city councilor when their community has not been able to safeguard the needs of older adults in disaster, there's no one else. The buck stops with them. So at the end of the day, it is those local officials, I think, who are in the best position to be responsive for forging the connections in ways that maybe get missed at the federal and state level.
But one of the things that I think is going on locally, at least where I live, and that's in the state of Connecticut, we really have not planned for affordable housing for people who want to stay independent for as long as they can. Mm-hmm. They can't afford the taxes, they're isolated, they are alone in this process. And that's the worst place to be when there's a disaster because of climate, whether it's a hurricane, a flood, whatever it may be. And let's be honest, when you live, say, in a suburban community and you had family around you, that was one thing. When you don't and you're on a one-acre lot, no one may be able to get in touch with you for some period of time, particularly when the technology has kind of gotten past you as well.
Yeah.
So there are so many of these factors.
It's true. And again, I think that's kind of where the real opportunity lies at the local level, supported by the state, of course. But I think all the nuances and the sort of challenges that you described about housing developments and housing development patterns is tied to zoning. And we have not, as a country, sort of, I would say, woken up to the need to really think about creating a different kind of housing stock going forward. We already know that there's a mismatch in the kind of housing supply that exists. So something like 85% of our housing stock is 2, 3, 4 or more bedroom, but about half of our population is 1 or 2 person households. And frankly, that share is growing. So we're already over-providing, if you will, larger, often, you know, suburban housing developments that are frequently auto-dependent. So again, that works great if you're driving, but when you become an older adult who's no longer driving, you really become isolated. You know, part of the solution there is to rethink zoning, to rethink the kind of housing that we're supporting and encouraging in our communities, not only because it can drive down the cost. So we all know that affordable housing is an incredible crisis all around the country. Part of the solution is just creating a lot more supply and a lot more supply of a different form of housing. So I would argue that smaller, denser housing that's in more walkable communities with better access to public transit that puts people in closer proximity to one another, that kind of a housing future is one that really speaks to the challenges that we're facing. When you're creating smaller, more dense housing, you're creating units that by design require less energy, that by design allow for people to walk to the grocery store in case they want to get their exercise or in case they stop driving and they're not allowed to drive anymore. But it also puts people in closer proximity where they can more easily look out for one another. And there's lots of ways to get there. We see a real wave of zoning reform in the country, real adoption of something called accessory dwelling units, which is made possible with zoning reform, and that would allow a homeowner, particularly, you know, people of any age, but especially nice for older homeowners, maybe who don't need all that space that they once had, but they want to live in their community. They love their neighbors. They love their community. It would allow them to build a smaller unit in the back of their home or in their basement or their
attic.
Yeah,
we've had that fight here in our state, and it hasn't gone too well in many communities. It's really somewhat shocking. Danielle Aragone is with us, Climate Resilience for an Aging Nation. And by the way, we've done other podcasts on zoning. I am right where you are on this issue, Danielle. I encourage people to go find those within the constellation of podcasts that we have done. It's a really important topic. You point out that when Hurricane Ian devastated Florida in 2022, two-thirds of the people who died were older adults. And then you talked about the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, and that changed how the city is preparing for future disasters, including constructing things called resilience hubs. What are they?
Yeah, the story of New Orleans is a really interesting one. I think, you know, we all can reflect back on scenes from Hurricane Katrina and really seeing older adults at their most vulnerable, being trapped in nursing homes, being trapped, you know, submerged, partially submerged by stormwaters. It was just devastating. As that community has endured disaster after disaster, most recently but not limited to Hurricane Ian and Ida, they began to realize that while evacuation had been the recipe for disasters for the first period of time, it became increasingly important to allow or ensure that people could withstand remaining in their home and remain safely in their home. And that's where resilience hubs come in. So where once they sought to evacuate older adults out of the city, often to a different state, they realized that comes with risks too. And so instead, and I mentioned earlier community-based organizations and the importance of them, this is where that sector has really, I would say, taken a lead role. They identified, many community-based organizations in this case is called Together New Orleans, realized that there was a real need to support older adults creating community lighthouses. And that is another term for a resilience hub. And resilience hubs are increasingly in use across the country. They're a public convening place where there's backup power in place, often from a renewable source. So solar panels are powering a battery in the building that lets people charge their phones, charge their medical equipment, have fresh food, fresh water, a place of safety, cooling and warming, depending on the conditions. But the thing about New Orleans that's so interesting is that they really paired that with kind of a ground game where they go out and they meet people, meet older adults in the neighborhoods where these community lighthouses are, get to know them well before the disaster occurs, make sure that they know how to get to the lighthouse in case of event. And they've made an intentional effort to put these lighthouses scattered throughout the community so that people can easily walk to them when the power is out. And I think really that's a perfect illustration to me of a forward-looking approach to resilience that grounds itself in the needs of older adults. It recognizes the importance of keeping them safe and healthy during extended power outages, which are becoming increasingly common, but doesn't just leave it to the built environment solution. They've paired that with really kind of a social network connection element as well, in ways that make it even that much more welcome and used by older adults, because that kind of connection, that familiarity exists well before the disaster strikes.
You talk about the overlapping needs here, because when we talk about older adults, we're talking about people who have often certain physical disabilities, chronic diseases, and they overlap with other vulnerable groups to prepare for climate change. And I'm wondering, because you worked at AARP, such a strong lobbying group, such impact in our society, and older voters are plentiful, and they do vote. You never have to worry, will the older voters come out? You always worry about the younger voters. So why is it that these needs, which as you outline them, are so apparent that they often are overlooked?
It's a really interesting question. I think it goes back to that kind of the siloed approach in which these two problems are being dealt with. So I think on the one hand, when people think about older adults' needs, they think about the senior center, they think about Social Security, they think about paratransit. They aren't necessarily thinking about climate-related risks. And on the other hand, when you've got people planning for climate change and climate resilience, they aren't necessarily honing in on and focusing on the unique needs of older adults. So I think that's kind of why some of this work has been overlooked. We tend to kind of paint a broad brushstroke and say that all adults experience climate the same, when the reality is we know that they don't. There's ample evidence now that older adults are more impacted. And by the way, that age overlays on top of all the other pre-existing inequities that are evident in our community, in our society, as a result of, you know, inequitable access to healthcare. So you see already a wide array of life expectancy based on race, based on income, based on zip code. Age just gets layered right on top of those inequities. So it on the one hand, it seems terribly obvious, and it almost makes me wonder why we're not talking more about this. But on the other hand, I think it's a byproduct of the fact that we haven't really acknowledged the intersection between these two disciplines yet in ways that will mobilize that kind of activity.
What does having such an older population in our midst, and I think we have about six generations working in America, I think that's for the first time, if I recall something that we reported on several years ago. What does that mean for a society like ours? And I know we are an age-sensitive society. We mm-hmm. like to think that we are youth-driven. At least we did. I know when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, we were always thinking about the future. And maybe we forgot about those who may be in the past in terms of their earning capacity, in terms of their value to society, quote unquote, because in many ways it's an economic value that we place on people. Mm. Why do we try to forget? Because number one, I'll tell you, when I go out shopping, and I'm one of the older people now, I don't like to admit it. Sometimes mm-hmm. I don't sound like it, but I am. Mm-hmm. But luckily I'm in good health for the moment. But the question is, when I go out shopping during the day, I see lots of old people out there generating lots of economic value to this society. How can they kind of forget about us?
That's a complicated question. And I really think that at the root of it, I'll just be blunt. I think it's ageism. I think it's a youth obsessed society that we live in, and we don't want to sort of acknowledge or look square in the eye the dynamics and the realities of aging. I will say, just recently there was an article in the Washington Post that did a feature on, I think, eight or different nine older adults. I think they were in their 70s and 80s, maybe 90s as well, on the kind of housing solutions that they landed on. And I have to say, it was breathtaking to me, because to me, for the first time, it read as a sort of non-judgmental, explanatory piece that unpacked individuals' choices about how they aged and where they lived. And it didn't sort of paint a picture of older adults as needy or frail or vulnerable, even though we know that there are frailties and vulnerabilities that come with older adults. But it really painted a picture of the kind of housing options available to them and the choices that they'd make. And those kinds of pieces are so rare, I find, that it's indicative of what you said, a lack of interest, a lack of desire to really talk about aging in our society. So I agree with you 100%. I think older adults are a powerful economic block, a powerful voting block, certainly a powerful block when it comes to sort of contributing to their communities and society through volunteerism and in many other ways, not to mention the sort of caregiving role that so many older adults play. It's an incredibly important part of our society and our culture, and I'll say some elements of our American, communities do better at celebrating elders than others do. And some it's organic and natural and celebrated, and others not so much. But I really do think it's rooted in ageism. And I think that this question of how we prepare for our climate future is a great opportunity to sort of put the needs of older adults squarely in the center, not from a paternalistic standpoint, not from a sort of frailty standpoint, but from a reality standpoint. If we are going to be communities that are comprised of more and more older adults proportionally over time, let's have an honest conversation of what that means in light of the climate risks that we face.
Well, I think you point out very clearly that if we look to the most vulnerable, and let's say the most vulnerable are those who have physical mobility problems, cognitive issues compounded by other factors as we age inevitably, mm-hmm. then we're going to do the best that we can do for everyone
Absolutely.
In our communities.
Yeah.
So why not plan for the worst? Because the worst is coming. It's going to get worse unless we make some dramatic change that I have not seen yet in the way we fuel ourselves and the way our energy supply is working. We're trying. We are working on that now. And I'm wondering whether the infrastructure bill that was passed about a year and a half ago. Did that account for any of this? Because transit and housing are two of the key factors in all of this.
So I think there are a couple bills that passed in the last couple of years, one of which is the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021, I think. And that made record investment in public transit. I mean, just unprecedented investment in public transit, as well as in broadband expansion, lots of other really critical pieces that can be deployed to help older adults age better in place, and particularly in light of our climate future, right? If we get more people connected, we get people better informed, we can get people can be more mobile and have more transportation options available to them. Then there was the Inflation Reduction Act that passed last year that had a whole slew of housing-related potential investments, not an explicit housing injection of money per se, but a ton of incentives for rebates to make homes more energy efficient, to decarbonize them, to put solar panels on homes, things like that, all of which really roll up to an incredible opportunity to change our housing stock and to make it more climate resilient. And when you think about the fact that older adults, particularly those on fixed incomes, who are confronting higher and higher utility costs, it's one of the most volatile sources of housing costs these days, along with insurance. If we can bring some of those costs down by, subsidizing energy efficiency investments or renewable energy that radically changes that the calculus and the math for people, then that's a real investment, frankly, in the climate resilient future that works not just for older adults, again, but it starts to create a different housing stock that's going to benefit everybody.
Technology, what role does it play? It could be our friend. We see all these new products where if you're having a problem, you can monitor your heart very easily, and you could call your doctor and say, I think I'm having an event, or there's some reading that is not right. I know that technology, if you're not willing to kind of go forward with it, can be a problem. For example, I've worked in radio for many years, and radio now is a depleted resource in many communities, whereas older Americans would use it often to really tell them what was about to happen and descend upon the community and such. And now it's lesser of a force. Podcasts like this and many others are having great impact, but younger people seem to skew to them. So technology in all of this, help us understand its role.
Yeah, I think, communication is a really important element of that. I think you're exactly right that when technology has evolved to the point where local officials or communities think that, posting something on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter is good enough in terms of public engagement, that leaves out a whole bunch of people who don't use those media. And we know that older adults don't use social media in the same way that younger adults do. We know that they don't even have in-house broadband, in-home broadband in many cases, or smartphones. So some of those are true wake-up calls to younger people who just assume that everybody has in-home internet and everybody uses a smartphone. So really, it almost sort of requires that local officials and communities employ old school techniques, right? Like door knocking and paper flyers and door hangers and things like that can be used to get the word out. When I think about sort of, in-home monitors and things like that, I think there's a lot of potential for monitors that can be used inside the home to help manage energy use and track energy use so that you can get a better handle on what that's going to cost. I think for, again, many older adults, a real fear of being able to not pay their utility bills is what keeps them from remaining safe in a safe and comfortable temperature, particularly when you think about waves of extreme heat. So I think there's technology in that regard as well that can be helpful.
People who are listening, whether they're younger or older, but they have an older person in their life, in their family that they care deeply about, what should they encourage that person to do? You say that older adults should bring up the topic of what's happening to them as their community is changing, as heat waves are more pronounced, as storms are of greater risk. They should talk to their medical providers, maybe even the simple task of getting to know their neighbors. What should the simple tasks be? I know that when you were at AARP, you developed a disaster resilience toolkit. How important would that be to get?
Oh, very important. I think that, you know, the more that people can become informed and educated about what it means to be prepared, the better. There's a ton of great resources out there from American Red Cross and FEMA and lots of organizations, including AARP, about how to be prepared for a disaster, for an emergency. The Disaster Resilience Toolkit tries to, you know, go a little bit further by talking about what is the role of local governments in planning for resilience as well. But I think at the household level, the individual level, I would say it does begin with those kind of basic conversations with your doctor, with your family, with your neighbors. What are the risks that we've experienced in the past? And more importantly, what are the risks that we're likely to experience in the future? You know, I think many parts of the country this year endured wildfire smoke, making the air outside dangerous. For someone who's got respiratory disease or heart condition, those risks are magnified. And so, you know, again, mapping the risks that we know or can anticipate against the realities of what that person as an individual is confronted with, how do we then take steps to mitigate that risk? In that particular instance, it could be thinking about getting air purifier. There's maybe that's a nice investment in creating a healthier home for a loved one in the coming year. So in some localities, they offer things called special needs registries, which allow for individuals to sort of self-identify to their emergency managers to say, I need a little extra help in the next emergency. That might mean someone checking on me. It might mean specialized transportation in case of evacuation, but I want to make my needs known now. I want to let you know that I'm mobility impaired or live with cognitive decline or live by myself or have a pet. Whatever the unique conditions are that I as an older adult are going to be challenged to manage when the next disaster strikes, we can make those known to emergency management professionals who are there to safeguard our well-being in advance. So that's a really proactive step. And then I've also heard things like, you know, making sure that your Social Security benefits are being delivered electronically through direct deposit rather than in paper checks. Because if you have to evacuate, if you need to relocate for some period of time, then you won't have to worry about that, the payments being delayed in any way. There's an array of things that people can do, but I think it begins with having this conversation in the family, with your friends, with your family, with your caregivers.
As we close, I just want to remind those listening that, again, when Hurricane Ian devastated Florida, 2/3 of the people who died were older adults. In Katrina, 70% of the deaths, yet it was only 15% of the overall population. California Camp Fire in 2018, 85% of the fatalities were older people. And then 2/3 of the Texans who died in 2021 from the cold weather snap where they lost their utilities. So this is not an unserious thing that we're talking about here. It is really deadly serious. And I thank you so much. This book is a great reminder and a help. Keep it by the bedside. Climate Resilience for an Aging Nation. Danielle Aragone. Danielle, thank you so much for being with us and for this book and being part of the America Trends podcast.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Larry.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.